This is Catherine O'Connell and welcome to Lawyer on Air. If you are looking for inspirational stories about women in law, then this is the podcast for you. Join me and my lawyer ladies as we enjoy a glass of wine after a hard day at work and talk about the world of women in law. It's my passion to share stories of amazing legal ladies who are working as in-house legal counsel, who have law firm roles, who are leading on boards, and who are doing law differently. From time to time, I will also invite special guests on the show to share their insights on legal recruiting and tips for getting hired as a successful lawyer in Japan. I hope you will enjoy getting to know these amazing women who I am so proud to share a profession with. I'm glad you're here and I hope you enjoy the show. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Lawyer on Air podcast. I'm the host of the show, Catherine O'Connell. In this podcast episode, I share with you yet another diverse story of a woman lawyer working in Japan. What I've learned from my career in law so far is don't shy away from reaching out to your network and asking for what you need. Well, those are the words of Carlotta Brussel, who is my guest today on the Lawyer on Air podcast. Carlotta is an arbitration practitioner working for Nishimura and Asahi as a foreign registered lawyer, Gaiben, to represent Japanese and international companies in pharmaceutical, manufacturing, and construction sectors. On this episode, Carlotta shares how she has had quite the international itinerary before coming to Japan to a big law firm, having career and life experience in Germany, Australia, Scotland, Hong Kong, and now Tokyo. She's proud of the non-typical law path she has traveled and invites you to connect with her if you want to do something similar for your career path. You'll also hear Carlotta's tips on how to master your Zoom interview for landing a legal role in Japan. And Carlotta shares her one big mantra she has for every single day, letting something go wrong so that other things can go right. And you'll also hear how Carlotta has enabled and manifested being in the right place at the right time to allow her niche combination of civil law and common law to bring her an exciting career in international arbitration. And Carlotta also shares her hot tips on food, travel, and all things Japan that she loves, as well as other fun facts, and her newly created International Arbitration Club. Let's get into it. Hello, Carlotta, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Catherine. It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Wow, I'm so excited that you're here. And the thing about this podcast is we are envisioning that we are sitting at a bar and we've pulled up and there's some drinks to be ordered. So tell me where we are. If we were meeting up in person for a nomikai, drinks at the bar, where would we be? Do you have a favorite wine bar? Or perhaps it's a cafe or restaurant that you love to go to? And what would be your choice of beverage off the menu?
I think at the moment I have to let you down and not invite you to a wine bar because I'm trying to be very good about not drinking. So I'm actually going to invite you to my favorite cafe, which is not much healthier than a wine bar, but it's called Cafe Hatto. It's in Shibuya, just 3 minutes walk from the station, so it's not too far. But it's this gorgeous little place that's very retro. It's got over 200 teacups decorating the walls, and they make the best chiffon cake in all of Japan, Tokyo, that I've been able to find yet. And they go through, I think, 50 chiffon cakes a day. And so I think I would like to invite you to Cafe Hatto, and we should order some chiffon cake.
Oh my goodness, I've just got this whole visual of what the wall looks like with the cups on it.
It's beautiful. It's incredible. I really recommend you go. Wow. And it's sort of like stepping back in time.
Wow.
Through their little door.
My mum, when she got married, she got this whole tea set with the sort of plate that has the sandwich on, the saucer and the cup. And they're all differently designed. So I'm sort of imagining that, but times 10 on the wall. And how pretty
it's a little
it
like
must
that.
Be. Oh, how lovely. Oh, and chiffon cake. I guess they've got different varieties too, because I quite like the Earl Grey chiffon cake. Have they got that?
They definitely do. They've got, I think, six different
Mm.
varieties.
Yum. Okay, it's a date. Let's do that. Sounds exciting. And not drinking's fine. Completely fine. And so I love that idea of going to the cafe. Thank you so much. And we're going to move into the first question, which I usually ask all the guests, so you probably know what's coming. If you think back to when you were young, maybe a child or coming into your adult years, what kinds of careers or what were you thinking about or dreaming about that you wanted to be?
I really dreamed about being an architect or an interior designer in many ways. I loved the idea of decorating things, and I loved the linear structure of design. I got very into architecture for a long time. But unfortunately, as I grew older, I realized that there was a lot of maths that's involved with architecture. And as soon as I realized that, I decided very quickly that that wasn't for me.
I hadn't thought about maths and the correlation with that and architecture. Yes, of course. Huh.
Yes, of course, because you need to calculate all the right angles. And I think if I tried to put a building together, all the walls would be wonky because my calculations would be off.
You still
But
bring that artisticness, though? Do you do it in some other way when these days?
not so much in my work. I do really like, and this is something I did later on in life, photography, and also over the corona period, while in lockdown in Sydney, I did a lot of baking and actually really enjoyed that, and started doing a lot of sourdough, which I think was popular, but I had previously started doing sourdough while we were living in Hong Kong and then got really into it during the lockdown and actually started selling it around my neighborhood. And that was very creatively fulfilling and not so math-based, but not really linked to the architectural origins of what I
Yeah,
wanted to be when I
well,
was
I
a
know you.
kid.
It's sort of designing and building a sourdough bread is kind of sort of architectural, I guess, and also quite entrepreneurial to be selling it in the neighborhood as well. How interesting. Wow.
Well, it was quite fun, really.
Yeah. So your formative years, how did you spend those growing up? Was that in Australia? Tell us about
It
that.
was,
Yeah.
yes, it was. So I moved to Australia from Germany when I was 9 and then lived in Australia until I was 17 and went to school in Australia in Canberra,
Oh, I
before
see.
I moved to university in the UK.
Right, so you're Germany, Australia, then back to UK. Gosh, that must have been
Correct.
interesting.
It was. I think it was a big adjustment as a child, but I've benefited so much from it. And it's really shaped my life and my career in many ways. I really love traveling and exploring new places. And luckily, I have a job now that allows me to do that. And it was one of the big reasons I chose this career. So, yeah, feel very grateful for
I'll
that.
come to that. I was thinking about Germany and Australia, quite different countries. Do you remember back then what struck you as, wow, this is so different to, all those years until you were 9, and then growing up in Australia? I would think beaches come to mind for me, but what do you think?
I don't have that much memory of those kind of landscape or physical manifestations of difference, but I think what was different for me was I didn't speak any English before moving to Australia. And so not being able to talk to kids in school or not being able to communicate with people was a huge shock. And I think as a child, when you're all of a sudden taken out of an environment where you feel very safe, you've got a lot of friends, and then you get popped into a place where you don't even speak the language, that's quite a big change. And I think that's really what I remember throughout that time.
So hard though, right? To do that, to not be able to talk with the kids at school. That would be so, I mean, not depressing, but it would be just so hard as a child to try and cope with.
Yes, it was a big change. I think I was lucky enough that I picked it up relatively quickly, and luckily German and English are not that different. So, I mean, it's nothing like learning Japanese, I can tell you that. I was very lucky in the sense that I picked it up quickly, and so I feel, but that's really the main memory I have going back, remembering not to being able to express myself properly.
Goodness me. And then at what point do you remember sort of thinking, oh, I'm okay now. I've caught it. I've got English. I feel okay. Was that later on? Was it around when you were 17 or probably before that, I would imagine?
It's actually really quickly. I
Okay,
think
good.
the kids' brains are incredible, and not just mine, everyone's, I think, are incredible because you expose them to something like that and they just pick it up real quick. And so when I first came to Australia, joined an introductory English centre, which is kind of like a school, but for people who don't speak English, and you essentially do your school day to learn English all day. And then I think maybe 5 months after that, I got to the real school.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
When I got to the real school, I sort of felt I could speak it. But I mean, still, that doesn't give you the sort of natural flow of language that I have maybe now, or the confidence in the language that I have now. And I think even now, I still try to study English words and try to read books to broaden my vocabulary. Because I think there's still disadvantages or even advantages to being someone who's not a native English speaker, because you just really have to study and find new words all the time.
That's right. And I mean, you're in Japan now, you're in Tokyo, and is that coming up again? You know, this language challenge.
It is, it is. I've really tried to learn Japanese. I'm not very good, but I'm starting to feel a little bit more confident in expressing myself.
Yeah, it is a different language because the verb structure, for example, English, you're quite direct, right? You say, I'm going, I think I'm going, I was going. But in Japanese, it's all at the end, which sort of helps with the vagueness because you don't decide what you're going to say, whether you're going, have gone, thinking about going, until you sort of hear the reaction of the other person in a way. So it's interesting how Japanese language, to me, how it falls at the end that you can make a decision. And it adds to the indirectness of Japanese language and Japanese culture in general. So I've found Japanese quite fascinating. And it takes a while to learn, that's for sure.
It's so true that you say that, and that vagueness in communication is something that is very new to me as well. I'm currently trying to learn a little bit more about Japanese culture, and I'm reading a couple of books about Japanese history and Japanese language development, but also the culture. And this idea of vagueness and silent communication and implicit communication is something that's incredibly fascinating in Japanese society, and something that's quite foreign, I think, for people who have grown up in the West. I'm not sure how you've been able to pick that up, but I found it really fascinating.
I think you're on the right path there, though, doing Japanese culture and history study because the language is so based in culture. Unlike English, where it seems to be pretty similar most places, maybe some vocabulary differences, you know, really basic things, you know, parts of the car like hood and bonnet and between America, say, and perhaps where I've come from. So there's that. But in Japanese is such a cultural thread woven through everything. So I think also you studying culture and the history is really going to help you to understand when something comes up at work or in the neighborhood or wherever it might be, you think, ah, that's what I heard about or studied about. So it's true, it has continued through the ages. It really is incredible how that's what I've found fascinating with Japanese. It's not just the language, it's the cultural interwoven parts that also make it really, really interesting for me. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I think you've put that really well.
All right. Well, that's great. I mean, a part of what I want to talk about is about the language because it is a different place to be. And a lot of people do get put off, perhaps, or don't think that Japan is a possibility because they think, oh, language is going to stop me. But with nearly 50 people recorded on this podcast, it's quite clear that language is, yes, it's a challenge, but it's not a deterrent to coming to study and to work and have a career in Japan. So, for you, I just want to go back a little bit there. When we're starting to talk about being a lawyer, when did that actually come up for you then? Because, at, say, 17, you're saying you were up in Australia till you were 17, and you're doing, and I know you did your LLB in England, oh, in Scotland, wasn't it? You did England and Wales. Qualification in Scotland. So, what's happening there after you're 17 and you're suddenly, well, it sounds like suddenly, but tell me about that in Scotland. How is that happening, and where is this lawyer concept coming to you?
That's a really good question. So the lawyer concept came to me actually relatively early after I decided architecture, not for me, too much maths. I was lucky that in Australia in year 10, you have to do I don't know whether it's the same in New Zealand actually, you do a work experience placement. And I was lucky enough to have a family friend who was Deputy Chief Justice of the Family Court. And so I was able to shadow him for a week or two while he went to court. And I worked with him very closely, or I didn't really work with him, but I shadowed him very closely for those 2 weeks and found the work that he was doing so fascinating. I think family court was never something that I would have been interested in, but it was such an incredibly interesting profession, and there were so many pathways that could open if one studied law. So from I think year 10 onwards, I really decided, yes, law I think is what I want to do. And then the path into litigation and arbitration came a little bit later down the line. But from having done that placement in the family court, I really knew that something that would get me closer to the law and resolving maybe even disputes at that time, that that would be something that I would be interested in.
Did you go into the courtroom and
Yes.
see some of those proceedings?
Yes. My first day, it was traumatic in a way, but my very first day, Chief Justice John Faulks asked me, "Do you believe in love?" And I said, as an impressionable year 10 year old, I said, "Of course, I believe in love." And then he took me into divorce hearings, which these were just the final motion to have the ruling on the divorce. And I think we heard 15 to 20 divorces before lunchtime.
No, really.
And
Wow.
quite after that, he said, "So, do you still believe in love?" And I said, I have to think about it. Because it was
Wow.
such a traumatic event, or not traumatic, but it was such a confronting experience to see all these people who had obviously entered into marriage thinking they loved each other. And then to have so many of those marriages resolved within a morning was just mind blowing.
Exactly. And was it more like a, it's the final, so it's sort of a stamp on the paper and it's declared,
Correct. It's just a
right?
declaration. But during my time at the family court, I was also able to listen to full cases and trials, or at least the hearings, parts of hearings, which were fascinating, but very, very sad. And I quickly decided that that wouldn't be something that I would want to do.
Yeah, I really give a big shout out to people who continue to do family law because it is very hard. I did some in the beginning of my career as well. And I think for me, the thing that I learned was how people interact with each other and how they don't interact with each other and how small things can turn into big things and resolving disputes at a very, very beginning, even if it's a fight with your friends or a dispute or disagreement with your brothers and sisters. It's something you just need to get at very quickly at the very early stages, or things just spiral. That's the big learning I got from family law. How about you?
I think my big learning from family law is that we are so lucky to have people who love us and appreciate us, whether that's family or not. But those relationships are worth so much. And those people who walk with you through life and support you in that way and who love you, regardless of family ties or not, we need to treasure them because it's very rare and very special.
I love that. I think it's very true, right? And that's where, as I just said, capturing those arguments or disputes or disagreements in the bud just is so important to be able to do exactly what you've said, carry on the love and the appreciation of each other throughout our lives. Really great to ponder that just at this moment, actually. So you had this amazing experience with this friend who was Deputy Chief Justice. What an experience. And that's made you think, I want to do law. And then you go to another country to do that. What happened there?
So, as I said earlier, I am German and I was interested in studying law, but was a bit torn about whether I wanted to do civil law, which is what is applicable in Germany, or common law. And luckily, in Scotland, they have a civil law system, but also offer English law degrees because there's such a nexus between the English common law system and the Scottish civil system. So Scotland, in a way, provided an environment in which I could study both civil and common law.
I see. So that's why England and Wales are put together, because they're common law, right?
Correct.
But you're doing it in Scotland. That's really interesting. How did you find that pathway? How did you know that that was, did you do a lot of research or find that out?
Is this, I did, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
How interesting.
Yeah, I really did a lot of research into that. So I loved my time in Scotland. I thought it was, it's a fantastic place. The people are very, very friendly and I really enjoyed my university.
Yeah, it's one place I kept aside from not going so that I can go to again in the future. I can't wait to go. Well, okay, so you finished there, and then instead of perhaps a lot of people might have, after they got their LLB, gone into private practice or perhaps in-house, but you decided to go further and do an LLM. And that wasn't in Scotland. That was in another city.
Yes, correct. So during my studies, really fell in love with international law and had a fantastic professor at my university who really inspired me. And I wanted to study that further and develop my career in that further. And at the end of my studies in Scotland, I had done a international moot for which I'd traveled to The Hague to participate in a competition there. And during that time, I met some arbitrators who told me about arbitration and this fantastic way to resolve disputes outside of a court system on an international scale that helps companies resolve their disputes quicker. And I really wanted to study more about that. And so I applied to go to Geneva to do my LLM and study there to do international disputes resolution, but also international law and economics. So I really wanted to learn more about arbitration and I wanted to do that through an LLM.
Wow, quite the package to throw all of those things in without maths, right? But economics is sort of almost getting close there. So hang on a minute, I'm going to go back to that moot. You did a moot at The Hague?
I did. It was fantastic. I recommend it to anybody. It's called the Telders International Moot. And it's actually the final rounds are held in the ICC or in the Peace Palace. And it's beautiful.
No way.
A very fun experience. It's stunning.
How did you Do you put your hand up for that and say, I want to do that? How do you get selected to do that?
It was the first time Scotland ever participated. So I heard about the moot and I told my university, look, I think this is a fantastic opportunity. I think we should enter a team. And usually, and I think it is now the case that lots of different universities enter teams from their country and then you have country rounds and then you pick the team from the country that wins and they get to go to the finals and then they moot through their finals. And then after that, they get to go to the international rounds in The Hague. So in a way, we were lucky because we were the only team from Scotland. So we got to go straight to the next level. And then once we'd passed through that next level, we were able to go to The Hague, which was just fantastic. So,
wow. Yeah. So you're your only team through, but you wouldn't have got there if you hadn't said, hey, let's try and do this. This would be great to do it, get a team together and do it. Your idea.
Correct.
Yeah. And yes. I mean, you're there and you meet these arbitrators. Is this serendipity that you've met these people and that you've gone through this process of getting nominated and you're in the Hague? Or do you think it's meant to be that you were actually driven to do that and you were meant to meet these people who were the arbitrators that got you on your path now? Have you ever thought about that timing, what happened then?
I'm not sure. I've thought about it a lot because I think in many ways my career is not very straightforward. But I was always lucky to be sort of in the right place at the right time, or at least manifest enough to fight to be in the right place at the right time. And I've always wanted to have an international career, and I've always found ways to do that. And I think that sort of started with this moot and meeting these arbitrators.
Did you know they would be there? Did you know there would be this group of litigators called arbitrators who would be at that venue?
I knew that there would be a lot of very influential people in the international disputes world. Yes.
So that's sort of in your mind also as you're submitting your group to go and participate in this event.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's quite strategic, as you say, you manifested enough to be in the right place at the right time. I love that. It's brilliant. So after the LLM, you then took another path, and I think that led you to Hong Kong.
Yes, so briefly via Canberra, where I was able to work in a small firm. I then moved to Hong Kong to pursue a career in international arbitration, which I still feel is, well, after my LLM was really what I wanted to do. And I really loved being in Hong Kong and being or working with the Hong Kong International Arbitration Centre, the HKIAC, was a fantastic experience. And I felt so lucky that I could work with them and get to know really arbitrations in and out.
Yeah, I think so, because you're in the middle of the cogs of that arbitration organization. I can imagine that you probably saw a lot of lawyers arbitrating, or you saw the briefs they submitted. Can you think about those experiences and what sort of tips you might have gained from, I guess, the way to be an arbitrator and not be an arbitrator? Perhaps their missteps that made you think, "Ha, this is really great. I know I want to do this work, but this is how I could really be a great arbitrator, and this is probably what I wouldn't do, which might hold me back."
I absolutely think that working at an institution like Hong Kong or in Hong Kong or in Singapore or in London is one of those places where you can learn so much, because working at an institution, you see so much of what the parties actually go through when they start and continue through an arbitration process. And you see good briefs and you see bad briefs and you think, oh, what have they done? Or this is a little strange. Or you see different drafting styles, you see different cross-examination styles, you see cases that are common law, civil law, you see arbitrators whose awards need to be amended or who need to do things a little differently in their argument, or you just get such a unique perspective into arbitration and you can learn so much.
Well, yeah, I would imagine being on the inside, it's like being on in-house lawyer and then going into private practice. You know what it's like on the business end of doing law, right? So you're seeing the business end of arbitration.
Correct. And I think
Wow.
at HKIC, we were also uniquely placed to give a lot of presentations to companies or to visiting intellectuals, universities, and have a great opportunity to really develop speaking skills, writing skills, networking skills. It was a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, and I guess too, even though you're based in Tokyo now, and Tokyo is also an arbitration center, that probably a number of the agreements that you deal with or that are being arbitrated do have Hong Kong as their seat for arbitration, yeah?
Correct. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I think that's why it's such a valuable thing for young lawyers to do. It is just an amazing opportunity to really learn the rules of an institution, to really learn how arbitrations can be most efficiently run. And I think I would recommend to any young professional who are really wanting to get into arbitration, try and join a institution for a year or more and really get to know the ins and outs of arbitration through that institution.
Right, so it could be if you wanted to be perhaps a litigator, you could also join a court behind the scenes there, right? And do something within the institution itself to learn the inner workings of how things go.
Yes, I think that is so valuable.
Right, interesting. Wow, I mean, that must have been an amazing experience and very hard to leave from. But, you're now in Tokyo and there are a couple of other steps along the way. What happened next for you?
When I was working in Hong Kong, I met Brenda Horrigan, who was a partner at Herbert Smith Freehills in Sydney, and she is now an arbitrator working in Singapore, but she was an incredible lady and I looked up to her tremendously. And she said, "Look, if you're interested in moving back to Sydney and into HSF, why don't you come and apply and join our team?" And at that time, it was my time to probably move out of Hong Kong. And so I took that opportunity and joined HSF in Sydney and joined their disputes team and worked a little bit in arbitration, mostly in class actions, which was a bit of a shift for me. But there's a lot of overlap between those types of large litigation proceedings. So I had a lot of skills that could be applied. And I loved my time at HSF. I thought the team was fantastic. And I think they do some of the best work in Australia on disputes. So it was a fantastic opportunity for me to be able to join that team.
Wow, amazing. And Brenda's going to be listening to this. I'm sure you'll share it with her. And how fantastic to have somebody there who, invites you back, and can see that something else for you would be a great experience to have in your toolkit. Class actions. I mean, I don't think we see much of them in Japan as such, but it's another experience to have to add to the whole rainbow that you've got. Because then after that, I think you then come to Japan. Is that right, Carlotta?
I do. I keep jumping around
No, it's
because
great. I mean, it's so great. And this is what's really important for people who are listening, indeed, is to see that you can do different things in different jurisdictions and have a really very, very interesting career path, even if it's not the traditional one. I think it's very valuable, and we can see how it's working and putting the pieces together. So tell us a bit more then about the Japan decision. What was the trigger for that? What prompted you to come here?
I think it was a plethora of options colliding where I thought, we've been locked up in COVID world in Australia for so long, and I wanted to go back to Asia. I wanted to do more arbitration, and I really had met so many amazing people through my time at HKIC that I wanted to be able to work with them again and share this passion for international arbitration that I have and really, really immerse myself into it. And I think Asia is such a unique hub for that. In addition to that, Japan is so incredible because it combines, again, similar to Scotland, that sort of civil law and common law legal system. And I really thought that that would be a fantastic place to do more arbitration work. And so I started looking into how I could move here. And again, it's sort of coming back to that manifesting what you want, and really, I don't know whether it's putting your head down and working for it or whether it's just manifesting it and then working towards that. But I really thought it would be a great place to be, and I wanted to go here, and so I started reaching out to networks and contacts that I had made in Hong Kong and wanted to really learn more about the Japanese arbitration market. And through that, I heard about Nishimura and their incredible reputation here in Japan. And when a position became available, I applied for it and felt very lucky that I was able to get it.
Wow. Okay. Did they interview you just on Zoom? Because it would have been still those times where it was very hard to travel. Or did you actually come through to Japan?
No, I did not come through to Japan. I did four rounds of interviews with various Nishimura Asahi partners who were all very gracious and very good at Zoom. So we spent many an evening chatting over Zoom, but they were very, very advanced and very, very great at doing these interviews. So I
Wow.
really didn't feel like it was a disadvantage doing them over Zoom. Everybody was so used to it by then that it became quite natural. And luckily, the time difference between Australia and Japan is not so great. So I felt it was very easy to do that.
How do you prepare for an interview on Zoom? How do you know what they're going to ask you? And perhaps you don't, but what's the advice you'd give to people who are preparing for, say, an interview with a Big Four Japanese law firm. And you don't have to give away all the secrets, of course, and your particular situation. But is there something that came up there that you think was really, really great that you prepared for, and thank goodness you did, that helped you get through an interview?
I mean, I think the question that everyone's going to ask you is why Japan, right? And I think there it's not enough to say, well, I like the food and it's pretty, but you have to really have a reason that you want to come to Japan. And for me, it was just this idea of the combination of civil and common law systems together with a growing hub for the law that I wanted to do, which is arbitration. And I think Japan has so much potential in that way. And I think Japanese law firm partners are very sophisticated, particularly in the Big Four, and they are going to be quite tough with their questioning. And you will have to be able to say exactly why you want to join them and what you can bring to the firm as well. And I think that is a unique aspect that everybody who's coming to Japan should think about. What can you actually bring to the firm? Because these big Japanese firms are very successful. They have so many high caliber clients. They have incredible work. What can we do to actually help them and make them better for their clients?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And so when did you find out that you would be coming to Japan? Did they just let you know by email and you then start the process? Do you remember when it was when you got that yes notice or information from them?
It would have been 2021 sometime. And then I didn't come over until 2022. Yes, but I'm not entirely sure. I think it would have been the second half of
It's a
2021.
bit of a blur, isn't it, for most things in that
Isn't
year? Yep, I agree with you. And then you recently qualified for the Gaiben, which is the foreign registered attorney, right? Foreign registered
Yes.
lawyer in Japan. I think that was late 2022. I remember seeing it come up because I think you're in the Dai-ichi Bar Association. I thought, who's this Carlotta lady? I have to get her on the podcast. So as soon as I saw your registration come up, I knew I wanted to talk with you because you're one of the very recent Gaiben qualifiers, and I think there's only been about 170 since I qualified back in 2018. So it's actually not been that many. I sort of calculating using maths, Carlotta, to
Oh,
calculate
no.
your number and my number. I found there was about 176 to be exact between you and me. But it just shows you there's not actually been that many Gaiben qualifying over the last 5 to 6 years, which is interesting, actually. Did the firm do all that for you, or did you participate in that in some way? Any learnings to share from someone who might be qualifying or going into qualifying for that, even though the firm may handle a lot of the admin for you?
I was very lucky, and I mean, hats off to the Nishimura Asahi team. They are fantastic. And I think, actually, for anybody who is thinking about applying to join legal firms in Japan, picking a firm that has experience with getting people here and getting them qualified in Japan is extremely valuable. And at Nishimura Asahi, we actually have a fantastic foreign lawyer committee. We have a partner who is in charge of the well-being and health, mental health, I think mostly, of foreign qualified lawyers. And we have an incredible admin team who helps us with these applications. And so, while of course I had to collect all my various documents to prove that I had practiced law for X amount of years and to show that I had done my degrees, as I say, I have done them, they all helped me incredibly through that. And I was actually very touched because when I was admitted, I was able to give the speech for the foreign qualified Gaiben for the day. So whenever you get admitted as a Gaiben, there are a group of you, and the most senior person or the most senior representative gets to give a little speech and thank the Gaiben group for admitting them. And I felt very honored to be able to give that speech. So it's a very touching experience, actually, once you get through the admin of it.
Wow, yeah. Do you remember what you said in the speech?
I think it was a mess of nerves, but thanked them for letting us join and obviously said that as foreign lawyers, we respect and want to uphold the traditions of the legal practice in Japan, and we'll do our best to contribute and bring positive benefits to Japanese legal practice as foreign lawyers.
Yes, exactly. It's funny. You reminded me of the day I was doing the same thing, but there was only me. So I wrote this, I did the speech on behalf of everybody who was foreign lawyer qualifying, who was only me. So it was quite funny. But they give a little guideline on what they'd like us to say, and it sounds a little similar. But yes, of course, we're here at the grace of the Japanese government and the Ministry of Justice to be practicing our country's law, our state law in Japan. And so, of course, we are here at the grace of the other Japanese lawyers, Bengoshi, and helping them. So I love how you've explained that. And yeah, it's a total honor, isn't it? Even though you just receive a piece of paper and nothing really much else happens, I hope you did have a little bit of a celebration afterwards, because it really is a big step to get that foreign lawyer qualification here in Japan.
Yes, and I think, you know, you said little piece of paper, but as lawyers, I think you start to really treasure little pieces of paper along the way. And so I do feel it's an incredible step. And I think we're so lucky as foreign lawyers to be able to practice, and particularly in a country like Japan, which has until very recently really been closed to foreigners and been, you know, a little bit more reserved in letting foreign influences into its space. I think how lucky are we to be able to be at the heart of an administrative system that runs this country. You know, lawyers, we have so much potential to do good and to be a part of that. So I think it's very exciting.
Indeed. Well, I want to move to your experience that you've got in civil law and common law, because perhaps that's what, when you were interviewing, perhaps that's something that was attractive for your firm, in that it's pretty rare, let's just say it, to have experience in both civil and common law jurisdictions. So I think that's helped you to stand out and create quite a niche or a niche here. How have you found that to be an advantage to you, the overlap in the work that you're doing now? And I sort of want to also move into, I was thinking of this before we spoke, like a Venn diagram of civil law in one circle and common law in the other, and what bit is in the middle there that overlaps, and how you're utilizing that to help you in your work right now. It's a big question.
Such a big question. One that's really difficult to answer, actually, because the civil law system that I learned in Scotland is still quite different to what I'm now doing in Japan, and what is also very different to the German system. And so I think obviously all these systems are unique, but really the big things that strike me is just really the commitment that lawyers make to the court system and to bring justice in a way. And I think that's really the main overlap, is that as lawyers, we have this commitment that we make. And I think that's really the main overlap. And then on, you know, the other sides of your Venn diagram, you get things like the actual law, which is obviously very differently from a historical perspective, built up, and you get actual practices in how you build on the law. So you get different practices in interviewing witnesses and drafting and things like that. So I think really in the middle of the Venn diagram, you get the commitment that legal practitioners make to the court. And then on the other sides, you get the legal framework and legal practices.
Yeah, that's so good. I love how you've put that. That duty to the court is certainly, you know, when we raise our hand, we put it on the Bible, when we commit as a common law lawyer, we are committing to uphold the rule of law to the court, and that duty. And so I believe that is the same, as you're saying, within civil and common. That is really interesting. But on either side, the practices of doing it are differently, the way we take witness statements, the way we submit documents. So in the work that you're doing now, what have you found really satisfying, rewarding, and that you're really proud of?
Oh, there's a lot. I think what I find really satisfying and rewarding is just the caliber of clients and the caliber of work that I have here in Japan, and also the caliber of my fellow lawyers at Nishimura Asahi. I think the standard here is absolutely excellent. Everybody is so diligent, they work so hard, and it's really a joy to work with people from different backgrounds to create a work product for a client that in the end you can be so proud of. And I think that's really one thing that I've so enjoyed coming here.
Any challenges you've had since you arrived that you've overcome? It's always helpful for people because, you know, no road in Japan is without its twists and turns and bumps. And so there might be one that you can call out that could be quite useful for people who are listening to think, how did she do that? How did she get around that one?
I'm not sure about one particular instance, but when I first arrived in Japan, I very quickly adopted a daily mantra of one thing will go wrong each day. And that might sound at first a little bit disheartening, but actually that might just be, you know, that one thing might just be I forgot my Passmo and I can't get on the train, or I've not got the right key to get into the office or whatever. But, you know, it was such a big move for me coming from Sydney, which is not such a big city, and having lived in such a very protected environment, and then coming to Tokyo by myself, so that I adopted that mantra. And actually, in many ways, it really strengthened my resolve, because there are so many little challenges that you forget to think about when you move to a different country. And just having that knowledge that, yes, something will go wrong today, but maybe it's something small and maybe it's something big. And as long as you're prepared for that, you can get through it.
That's so brilliant, right? We often talk about, oh, I'm going to do this as my goal, and today's going to be a great day. But you're talking about focusing on the other thing, giving yourself, I think, ease, right? It's like creating that, what's it going to be today? It's almost exciting. It's almost exciting, isn't it? Of, oh, what's it going to be? Oh, there we are. I forgot my wallet. Or, oh, there we go. I didn't do this and that. Or I ordered the wrong thing at the restaurant and I got the wrong meal, or whatever it might be.
So true. And I think, you know, those things will happen. And if you know one of those things will go wrong every day, then you think, oh, well, it's not such a bad thing when it does happen. Or, you know, you don't feel like, oh, I'm doing this all wrong because something went wrong today. You just think, well, that was the one thing that was going wrong today, and it's gone wrong, and now I can move on.
That is so good. I love that. And also, if it doesn't happen, you can celebrate nothing went wrong today.
Exactly. And that's a really rewarding thing. I remember the first time I ordered my coffee just the way I like it at the takeaway, I just was so proud because, you know, my Japanese was no good. And every day I'd end up with the wrong bag, or, you know, a receipt that I didn't need. And when I had it down, I just thought, yes, I managed to do that. And
absolutely fantastic. Well, I'm going to ask you to finish a question for me, or finish a sentence. And because I think we've come to a good point where I can ask you this, is the most important thing I have learned from my career so far in law is?
Not to shy away from relying on your network and asking for what you want.
Tell me more.
When I was in Hong Kong, I made so many really great connections, and I felt so lucky to know so many brilliant people. And I think you meet those people and they're so inspirational and so amazing, and similar to the people who I've met here in Tokyo now. But as women, we often get told, oh, you know, you've got to be polite and you've got to be nice and you can't reach out and ask for what you want, in a way that sort of gets instilled in us to be, you know, a little bit more reserved. But I think it's so important to just say what you want and ask the people who you meet for that. So I think don't shy away from asking the people who you meet to either have a coffee with you and chat about career options. Or, like I said, when I first moved to Tokyo, I reached out to connections I had here when I was planning my move to Tokyo from Australia. I reached out to the connections I had made here to say, hey, what's the market in Tokyo? who should you apply for? Who are the big firms? Who does the most amazing work? And often people will actually appreciate you reaching out to them and won't see it as a burden. And I think that's the most important thing I've learned, is people who you connect with actually appreciate when you ask them questions.
Oh, absolutely. And I think if you've treated them well along the way, they're certainly not going to see it as a burden, and they will appreciate you asking. They'll be flattered. They'll be wanting to help. I think if you've been a little different in the way you treated people along the way, they may not want to help you or feel a little bit reticent. But so absolutely true, right? Say what you want from people and actually ask them for it. Absolutely great advice. Also, Carlotta, you seem to be very organized. I'm not sure if you are a swan on the water and everything underneath the water is moving very, very fast with your legs, but you seem to be very, very organized. How do you organize your day? Do you have any hacks or anything for time management that makes you quite efficient?
Yeah, I'm a big sort of planner. I like to plan in advance. So the first thing I usually do on a Monday morning is I keep obviously my work diary, but I also keep a notebook, which is not actually a diary, but on which I sort of draw the days of the week. And then I write down every day my big appointments, the workout that I want to do that day, and whether I have certain plans for lunch or if I've got, you know, things that I want to eat that day. So I do that first thing on a Monday morning, and I split the page in half, and on the one side I do the meetings and the work things, and on the other side I do the workouts and the food. And then in a way that helps me with a certain task list of, you know, this is my life and my fun, and this is my work, and this is what I want to do this week. So I think that's how I plan my weeks.
I love that, right? So it's not your diary or your planner or the online calendar. It's something else that's visually in front of you that sort of lays your week, and you can see your literally your balance right on both sides of that page.
Exactly. And I keep that, actually I keep that piece of paper or the notebook in front of me all week, and then Friday I chuck it in the bin, which is actually quite a rewarding thing if you can strike everything off that list and chuck it in the bin and say, yeah, done. And then you can move on next Monday, new list.
You don't keep it. No. You throw it away.
I do, yeah.
And is there something satisfying in that? Is there something in that? The satisfaction of throwing it, but is there something else in that it's a fresh week, fresh start, and you don't pull something through from the previous week? Or what's
the I do pull things. That? Oh, actually, yeah. So I do pull things. I do pull things through. So if there is something that I haven't achieved and I haven't been able to tick off, I'll transfer it in advance to the next page for Monday.
Oh, good.
So then it'll be in the margin on Monday already.
Right. Okay.
And I write my new list.
Wow.
I still have the satisfaction of throwing away the piece of paper.
Some people do like a ta-da list, right? It's done, 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 and tick it all the way through, but or put red lines through. I often do that. But I love that you've actually screwed it up and thrown it away too. That's actually quite physically representative of I've done it, which is another great thing. Thank you. That's interesting. I really love asking hacks for things, because people often don't know how to do some things, and it can be even something like that, quite simple and straightforward, but with a lot of thought involved, that's really helpful. Yes.
So much of it, you have to just figure out what works for you. This works for me and has for a while.
All right. Two last sort of questions before we wrap up. But one would be another, perhaps a piece of advice you would like to offer up for young people thinking about coming to Japan for a career. We talked a little bit about your interview and we talked a bit about language, etc. But is there something you have up your sleeve that you'd like to share with people about, advice that you would like to offer up?
My advice is twofold. And the first one is maybe the more important one in a way, because I think there's this perception that it's very hard to get into Japan unless you speak Japanese. And I think that's something that you shouldn't let stand in your way. I think there is enough opportunity in Japan where we've got critical mass of fantastic practitioners in all legal fields, and you do not need to speak Japanese to come here. That's my first thing. And I think the second thing is find something that makes you unique and that you can really leverage to be good for the firm or the company that you want to join or whichever you want to do. Make sure that you've got a little niche that helps you contribute to that company.
Brilliant. Brilliant advice. I absolutely agree with that. And any particular advice that you would hone in on for other women lawyers in particular?
I guess, again, asking for what you want and don't be afraid, I think, is really the big thing. And connect with women in the profession. I've recently been able to connect with the Women in Law Japan more, and I think that is such an amazing network. And there are so many incredible practitioners who you can connect with and build relationships with, and women supporting women is just so important. And so I think don't be afraid to reach out to other women and ask them questions or connect with them to discuss different topics. And I think join any network that you can with other women and find strength in that.
Brilliant. I agree. Awesome. Is there anything we didn't cover today that you wanted to mention, or actually anything you want to ask me?
I wanted to, if we could, briefly just chat about, I'm trying to start a Japan Arbitration Club for young Japanese arbitration practitioners or practitioners practicing arbitration in Japan, whether that is, you know, someone working for the government or in-house or a legal practitioner. And I think I really want to just stress again how important it is to build on your networks. And I'm hoping that setting up this club will enable that for some young practitioners in Japan. So I hope that can be something that will bring more excitement to the Japanese arbitration practitioners who are young in Tokyo.
I'm trying not to shout out here and scream on the microphone. That is absolutely fantastic. I love this idea, and what an inspiration to be starting a club like that. And I think calling it a club is so good, because there's so many different things in Japan, like a benkyokai, like a study group or something. But if you call it a club, it's going to be so much fun. And you're going to bring together like people who were looking for the place to go to do this.
Exactly. And it should be stressed that it's sort of more of an enthusiastic group of practitioners who want to come together and have fun discussions about arbitration topics, or who want to get together to really bring a fresh attitude towards arbitration in Japan.
Brilliant. What do you need? I'm going to ask you, what do you need? You're going to ask, I know, at some point, not being shy, you're going to ask for things from your network, and we will put some notes in the show notes later for this. But what do you need? What would you like to have from people listening who want to help you and want to be part of this?
I just want an open mind. I think people who are interested should join or look up on LinkedIn for the Japan Arbitration Club and just come along with an open mind to our events. We're having an event in April, on the 17th of April, and hopefully that will be a success and we'll take it from there. I think an open mind and a fun attitude will be all that I want from people at the moment. And
brilliant.
Hopefully I can always come back to you, Catherine, and ask you for help and advice. And
Definitely. So we look for the LinkedIn group called JAC, Japan Arbitration Club, and you've got your first event April 17. That's great, because this podcast episode will be out before then.
Fantastic. Thank
Brilliant.
You so much.
I'm so excited to hear that. Well done, you. Let's finish up then with a just slightly lighter note, the Super 6, a quick fire round of six questions. And from a few episodes ago, I've been looking at some more sort of Japan-centric items because I've found quite a few people listening to the podcast really enjoy hearing more about Japan. That's part of the interest of listening. And so the first question is, what's your favorite Japanese food and where do I get it from?
Oh, I think my favorite Japanese food is Japanese curry. And it's such a comfort food, particularly now in winter. And you can get it pretty much anywhere. I think most little cafes will do a Japanese curry, but there's an excellent one called Peppers, which I recommend.
Brilliant. Lovely. Thank you. And the place in Japan you most recommend people go to when they're visiting here?
Oh, I think Kyoto always wins, but my favorite is probably Osaka. I love the retro feel, the food. There's a lot of fun things to be able to be doing in Osaka.
I agree. I've lived there 4 years when I was with Panasonic, so I know retro is actually a really good way to explain and describe Osaka. How about the question three then? What's the one thing you love about Japan?
I can't pick one. I love how easy life in Tokyo is. I think people underestimate how living in such a big city could be overwhelming, but it's such a convenient lifestyle and simple things are just made so easy for you, like paying your bills through the konbini and and taking the trains, which are cheap and fast and efficient and always on time. Life in Tokyo is convenient and easy, and I love that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I certainly love like redelivery of packages. Oh, so brilliant, right? If you're not home and they come back at the time they say they're going to come. Brilliant. Your favorite saying, either in English or Japanese or German, any language is fine. I know you also speak French, I think, too. But what is your favorite saying?
It's not a very sophisticated one by any means, but I love the just keep swimming from Nemo. And I've always made it a little bit of a mantra for my life. So whenever something bad comes up, I just think, just keep swimming. And more so in later life now, because I did a little bit of ocean swimming. And I think just that it brings back that feeling of the ocean and just pushing through and overcoming hurdles. So just keep swimming is my favorite saying.
Oh, love it. Nemo, who knew? Wow. And can you share a book that you're reading or have listened to a podcast recently, perhaps something that you'd recommend?
I'm actually reading a really fascinating book at the moment called The Japanese Mind, and I would highly recommend it to anyone interested in understanding different concepts from Japanese culture. So as I was mentioning before, I'm trying to learn a bit more about Japan, and this book is a series of short essays written by students from Ime University, and they describe different concepts like Japanese funerals or the concept of nimawashi or silent communication in Japan. And I really found that such a helpful book just to understand different concepts and really engage with Japan.
Very interesting. That's great. The Japanese Mind, we'll pop that in the show notes. And the last question is, what's something about you that a lot of people don't know?
I think probably what I mentioned at the start of the episode is my bread making. So I really ran this bread making business in Sydney, and I don't think everybody knows that about me in Tokyo, which was
That's interesting.
My bread making.
There's a chap who's from England who is making a cake every day, and he delivers it to somebody in Tokyo, and he posts everything. He posts it on Instagram, and he posts the person receiving the cake and a little bit about them, and they're just ordinary people. And it's really
I love that.
Yeah, I'll share it with you. But that's another fun thing, and I love that you're doing your bread making and kept it up. It's really cool. Thank you. Well, Carlotta, we have come to the end of our chat today. Thank you so much for coming on Lawyer On Air podcast. I know if we were sitting at the bar, we'd be continuing to have another sparkling water and continue our conversation. It's just been such a pleasure to speak with you, and I really loved connecting with you in this way. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for having me. It's been a real honor.
For listeners who are interested in connecting and learning more from you, where's the best place to reach out to you? Would that be LinkedIn?
Yes. Find me on LinkedIn. And as I said, please feel free to ask me anything. I always love getting questions and I try my best to get back to them. So LinkedIn, Carlotta Brussel is me.
Brilliant. Be careful what you ask for. It might just start flooding. That's great. You'll have lots of people come and join the Japan Arbitration Club as well. And to my listeners who are listening in, thank you so much for listening to this episode. And I hope that if you're inspired in some way by what you heard, please do subscribe. We'd love to hear from you what your biggest takeaway was. Head on over to Apple Podcasts, leave a review, or hop onto the website and leave us a voice review or a text review. Please go ahead, though, and share this episode with someone else who you think would enjoy listening and be inspired to live a lawyer extraordinaire life. That's all for today. See you on the next episode. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now. Thank you so much for listening today to this episode of Lawyer on Air. I really hope that you were inspired by the story you heard and that you discovered something new about women in the law. Please subscribe to the show so that you don't miss future episodes. And if you can think of even just one person to share this episode with, that would make my day. I invite you to connect with me to talk more. Jump on over to LinkedIn or Instagram where you can find me, or send me a message via my website contact page. That's all from me today. I look forward to seeing you right here on the next episode of Lawyer on Air. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now.